Everil Haines is the new director of national intelligence, the first woman in U.S. history in charge of the country's 17 intelligence agencies. In her confirmation hearing last week, Haines promised to bring a specific set of values to her new job.
The DNI must uphold our democratic values and ensure that the work of the intelligence community, mostly done in secret, is ethical, is wise, is lawful, and effective.
Ethical, lawful, effective. In the clandestine world of intelligence ops, that's a tricky balance to strike. And in fact, Haines's critics look to her past work in the Obama administration and see in her, a former CIA deputy director and former Obama deputy national security counsel who crafted policy that might have been lawful, maybe even effective, but perhaps not ethical. Specifically, Averil Haines helped author the legal framework for the Obama administration's use of the CIA's covert drone program. Her supporters say Haines reined in the use of drones for targeted strikes. Her critics say she provided the justification for extrajudicial assassinations. Here's CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou.
We know that Averil Haines at the NSC was in charge of determining whether it was legal or illegal to place people on John Brennan's kill list. We know that in almost all cases, she said it was legal to put these names on the kill list, and people were subsequently killed by drone.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and today we're going to talk about Averil Haines, the new Director of National Intelligence for the United States. We'll talk about America's drone program under Obama and now President Biden. And most importantly, the future of the old war on terror. Well, let's begin today with Rita Simeon, Director of National Security Advocacy at Human Rights First. She teaches courses on targeted killing, covert action, and the law of armed conflict at Georgetown University Law Center and American University Washington College of Law. Rita, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So let's start roughly around 2013, just to get a better understanding of Averil Haines' role in the Obama administration's use of the CIA's drone program. What first brought her into this orbit of how the Obama administration used drone strikes?
Right. So Haines initially, you know, was a lawyer at the State Department, but then came over to the White House and was in several roles in the White House, and in between was also deputy director at the CIA. So she was a national security legal advisor, so performing more of a lawyer role, but then also was, after her deputy director role at the CIA, came back as deputy national security advisor. So she served in a number of different roles, both legal and policy, with respect to national security more broadly, but with respect to the drone program in particular.
Now, it was in 2013, though, that she was tasked with creating new guidance for the Obama administration, because look, the Obama administration had come under significant criticism from civil rights and human rights groups around the world, because at the time, the administration had essentially said that any military age males, within the strike zone of a drone attack were considered by the United States as enemy combatants. I mean, that is as broad a definition of enemy combatants as you can get. And therefore, that was the justification that the Obama administration used to legitimize the attacks, or who died in these drone strikes. So Haines comes in, and she was tasked with co-authoring new guidance for the administration, which was then eventually released or adopted in May of 2013. How much tighter did that guidance make the use of the drone program?
Yeah, so, you know, it's important to remember that the sort of concerns or dispute actually is much broader than these like sort of legal disputes over military age males, et cetera. It really goes back to the entire sort of war paradigm or war-based approach, right? So in the Bush administration, after 9/11 happens, the Bush administration decides to respond to 9/11 by putting the country on a war footing. So in using indefinite military detention, utilize in military commissions and saying this is war, which sort of opens up this whole set of authorities, including to use lethal force as a first resort rather than as a last resort in very narrow circumstances, as would be the case under normal peacetime rules. So it's really this sort of fundamental dispute about whether and when, where and against whom lethal force can even be used. And it goes to this like fundamental dispute over whether this is even the right sort of legal paradigm. And then you get into these finer disputes about how, you know, whether they're even applying the laws of war appropriately or narrowly enough. So there are all these concerns, as you mentioned. And so the Obama administration, not only feeling the heat of these concerns, you know, domestically, but also from allies that are our partners in many of these operations that are applying stricter standards, but also fears that a recognition that they're going to be handing these authorities over to whoever's in the White House next. So they rightfully recognize that some additional constraints are needed, and they begin to put together sort of policy guidance that puts in place restrictions that are, you know, they're stricter than what would be required in some ways under a war-based paradigm, but they don't go as far as what many believe would be legally required under a sort of peacetime human rights law, you know, law enforcement paradigm that many believe is actually the appropriate set of standards. So it's sort of an in-between set of rules that they decide to put in place. But it's internal executive branch policy guidance that can easily be reversed by whoever comes in next. And that's a big part of the problem.
Right. So,
because that's exactly what happened.
I was going to say the Trump administration did exactly that. Now, but about the guidance specifically, I mean, there is a redacted version available to the public. And I was digging into it yesterday. And while there's certain aspects of the guidance that do tighten the rules around when strikes would be appropriate, drone strikes would be appropriate, right? Like they're, for example, they say that direct action must be conducted lawfully and taken against lawful targets. But the entire section where it defines how the CIA might define such a target is entirely redacted. So we don't know what criteria the CIA was told to use. And also, to your point about international law, there weren't many or any, if at all, as far as I can recall, specific references to specific international laws that the United States would agree to follow. Now, this is really important because is it not true, per what you were saying a little earlier, that regardless of what Avril Haines might have written in this guidance, the Obama administration was still using that initial authorization of the use of force from after 9/11 that Congress gave the Bush administration vis-a-vis Afghanistan, but was using that as the justification to do strikes in, say, Somalia or Yemen.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, there's sort of two sets of concerns that you've noted here, right? So one is that, you know, within days of the 9/11 attacks, Congress passed what it thought was a very narrow authorization to use military force against those who were responsible for the attacks, named, you know, Al-Qaeda, and those who harbored them, which is the Afghan Taliban. So that's what Congress had in mind. And yet that authorization, nearly two decades later, is still what the executive branch is relying on for using force against a whole host of organizations, including some like ISIS that didn't even exist at the time that the authorization was passed by Congress. But the other problem you raise, right, is this, the question of international law and compliance with international law as well. So it's not laid out in the policy, as you mentioned, but the Obama administration, shortly before it left in December 2016, they did release a sort of framework report that lays out its understanding and interpretation of international law, and including, you know, how international law applies to the drone program. So there was, you know, some helpful transparency so that we can understand at least how they were applying and interpreting international law. The problem is there's a lot of disagreement with how they were actually applying and interpreting international law.
Hmm. So specifically then about following this new guidance that Haines helped author, we do know that the number of strikes that the Obama administration authorized did go down quite a bit. But nevertheless, they continued. You heard that tape that we heard from John Kiriakou before. I mean, how directly was Avril Haines involved in authorizing the strikes that did occur after 2013?
Yeah, I mean, it's been reported, right, that she was, you know, receiving calls in the middle of the night asking, you know, to sort of weigh in on the legality of specific strikes. It's hard to say, of course, from the outside exactly what her role was. But I think we can sort of look to what the Obama administration did as a whole, which, you know, she was certainly a part of that. And I think the administration as a whole and Haines in particular, they sought to put constraints in place because they recognized that this was an extraordinary power and they were right to do so. The problem is that ultimately this effort really just sort of entrenched a framework for continuing these lethal strikes without sort of a long-term rights-respecting sustainable strategy for these authorities.
So I think what you said there is extraordinarily important. So it provided a framework to entrench these strikes without a long-term human rights strategy that went along with it. So what was your response? We've just got a minute to go before we take the first break here. In Avril Haines' confirmation hearing last week as DNI, the word drone was not uttered a single time. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting and concerning that, you know, this has become so normalized that it, you know, was not a major point of discussion or really a point of discussion at all. But we do know that, you know, President Biden has said very clearly that he wants to end the forever wars. And to do so, they're really going to have to grapple with a very significant component of the forever wars, which is this lethal targeting, the drone program that can't continue and also end the forever wars at the same time. They're going to have to figure out how to reconcile those two things.
Well, Rita Simeon, stand by here. We're talking about Avril Haines, the new director of national intelligence for the United States, and what her appointment means for those forever wars, that war on terror. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And this hour, we're talking about Avril Haines, the new director of national intelligence, the first woman to hold the position. She was nominated by President Joe Biden and confirmed by the Senate. She has a previous history, but in the Obama administration, that's quite crucial to understanding how the Biden administration might view and operate the war on terror, specifically around drones and drone strikes. And then a bit later, we'll talk about torture as well. I'm joined today by Rita Simeon. She is Director of National Security Advocacy at Human Rights First. And let's listen to a little bit of tape from back in 2013 regarding drone strikes. A Yemeni youth activist named Fareya al-Muslimi testified at a Senate hearing about a drone strike that hit his village. The target was a suspected terrorist, but many civilian casualties occurred as well.
Just 6 days ago, my village was struck by an American drone in an attack that terrified the region's poor farmers. My understanding is that a man named Hamid al-Radami was the target of a drone strike. Al-Radami was well-known to government officials, and even local government could have captured him if the U.S. had told them to do so.
Now, Avril Haines herself was a guest on the podcast International Law Behind the Headlines a year ago in 2020, and on that podcast, she was asked about the legal justification for targeted drone strikes, targeted drone assassinations. One of the conditions for legality is that the United States government could prove that the target, the person, was preparing an imminent attack on Americans. But Haines, in this podcast last year, admitted that the definition of imminence had been stretched in the war on terror.
Between the George Bush administration and the Obama administration, have we stretched the meaning of imminence so much that it is actually no longer sort of has content and is constraining? And I would argue that, yes, we did work through imminence, and it is a broad definition, but it's not meaningless.
That's Avril Haines herself on a podcast last year called International Law Behind the Headlines. Well, joining us now is Chris Whipple. He is an author of several books about various aspects of presidential administrations, a documentary filmmaker as well. His most recent book is The Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Chris Whipple, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
So give us your take here on what lessons you might draw from Avril Haines and her approach to intelligence work through this lens of her involvement in the Obama drone program. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, I was struck by something you said earlier, which is that the subject of drones never even came up in Avril Haines's confirmation hearings. And it just underlines the fact that drones really are sort of the forgotten scandal. And I can recall that Bob Gates, the quintessential veteran CIA director, told me at one point that he wonders, I interviewed him for my book, The Spy Masters, and he said, you know, you have to wonder if 10 years from now we'll be talking about drones and drone warfare in the same way that people talked about the enhanced interrogation techniques, which were, of course, such a huge scandal and so radioactive at the time. But the truth is that we're not talking very much about drones these days, and I think that's probably unfortunate.
So, Rita, let me turn back to you here for a second. We're not talking about drones very much these days, even though, per your point earlier, the Trump administration essentially, you know, threw Avril Haines's guidance, that legal guidance, into the dustbin and expanded or sort of increased the number of drone strikes over the course of Donald Trump's 4 years in office?
So I think, you know, to Chris's point, right, the challenge, right, or I think the explanation in part for why there is less attention paid to this issue is that it's more complicated. So torture is always unlawful. It's always unethical. There is no justification that makes it lawful in particular circumstances. But lethal force is more complicated. And so it's harder for people to understand what the concern is with lethal force, because there are times when it is lawful, when it's appropriate, when it's, as you know, to use Haines's words, it's ethical, wise, lawful, and effective. But those are really narrow circumstances. So the complexity of it, I think, makes people, you know, they have a hard time understanding why it's so concerning.
But I mean, if you're, say, the nation of Pakistan, you don't have a hard time understanding it, right? I mean, in 2013, in December of 2013, what, 7 months after this sort of guidance that Avril Haines helped author for the Obama administration, the National Assembly of Pakistan unanimously approved a resolution against U.S. drone strikes in the nation of Pakistan, calling them a violation of the Charter of the UN's international laws and human norms. I mean, so it seems pretty clear if you're on the receiving end of the strikes.
No, exactly, right? And I think, you know, all it takes is a little bit of imagination for those of us, you know, sitting here in the United States to think about, you know, would we want another country to have the authority to say that my neighbor down the block is someone who is an enemy combatant of that state, that they are at war with that individual and the group that they're allegedly a part of, and to be able to blow up that neighbor's house. And then, you know, maybe they're correct, maybe they're mistaken in terms of the neighbor's identity, but is that the kind of world we want to live in? And so, you know, we can argue about the, you know, the legal framework and the nuances of the law of armed conflict, but at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself these sort of bigger picture questions about the kind of world that we want to live in, right? And this is to Chris's point of how we're going to look back on these decisions decades later.
Right. I mean, look,
can I just add to that? I mean, it's absolutely true that drone warfare is a fraught, controversial, and also complicated subject. You can make a very strong case that because of the extraordinary accuracy of drone warfare, that it is far preferable to B-52 strikes or boots on the ground attacking, an enemy outpost. So it's extraordinarily complicated. And I tell the story, and it's also a very wrenching human decision that every CIA director has to make. In The Spy Masters, my new book, I tell the story of how Leon Panetta was shocked by the extent to which he had to make life and death decisions almost every day. And at one point, he's standing at the graveside of a young woman who was killed in a suicide bombing in Khost, Afghanistan, a young CIA officer, when he gets word from Operations Center that there's an Al-Qaeda terrorist in the crosshairs of a CIA drone at that moment. And he spends the rest of the day a devout Catholic, with his rosary beads and saying a lot of Hail Marys, making a decision about whether to authorize that strike when he knew that there were some civilians, quote, in the shot, end quote. And Panetta ultimately gave the go-ahead. Some civilians were killed in the strike. And he said, Chris, at the end of the day, all you can do is hope that God agrees with you.
Well, so again, in Haynes's own words, that three-pronged system of values of being ethical, lawful, and effective. I mean, I hear in your story, Chris, the ethical wrestling that that CIA directors who were making these calls had to go through. But about the point of effectiveness, right? The effect was intended to curb or reduce or dismantle terrorism and terrorism-related groups who were at the receiving end of these strikes. Now, Pakistan's former prime minister, Nawaz Sharif, once said that, in fact, the U.S. drone program was detrimental to Pakistan's resolve at eliminating terrorism from their country. So on that point, I wonder if you, Chris, you and Rita could just listen along with me, because we wanted to get the view of what these strikes were like from someone who had been in the region, and specifically in this case, drone strikes that took place in Yemen. So Iona Craig is a freelance investigative journalist who lived in Yemen from 2010 to 2015. She goes back every year as well. And she's been covering America's drone program under the Obama and Trump administrations. And she described for us the first time she saw the aftermath of a U.S. drone strike. This was in 2013 in a village in the Yakla district.
It was an Obama-era strike on a wedding convoy. And the strike had killed 12 men, civilians, and they were en route to the bride's house. And when I went down to the village where this had happened, I met many of the children. And it's always the children that I remember from these strikes, really.
17 children lost their fathers in the drone strike on that day. And Craig remembers one boy in particular, around 10 years old, named Salem.
He sat there silently amongst all of his siblings and his aunts, and he was kind of shell-shocked. He just stared into the middle distance whilst I sat there talking to the others and trying to talk to him.
Craig says that after a strike, CIA drones constantly circle overhead, and she describes it as a kind of psychological warfare against the local people who never know when the next strike will happen.
When you spent a full day under that sound, and we don't call them drones for nothing, but that kind of buzz, I found myself waking up in the middle of the night convinced I could still hear that sound. It's on a pitch that never changes. And even when you looked up into a bright blue sky that was entirely clear, you can't see them, or I couldn't, and you try. But yes, you could hear them. And it literally gets inside your head like a a fly or a bee in your ear. Of course, for many people living under there, that's the constant threat of death all the time, because every few weeks or at least once a month, one of those drones will be firing missiles into the ground.
Now, both the Obama and Trump administrations viewed drone strikes, as Chris Whipple said a little bit ago, as an anti-terrorism tool of surgical precision, one that eliminates the need to put U.S. boots on the ground. But on the ground, Craig says villagers often witness drone attacks and the gruesome deaths of their own family members. And the result, she says, radicalized survivors and a new anti-American sentiment.
You know, I've had incidences when men have turned around to me and said, now we are at war with America, or we will go to war with America over this.
That's freelance journalist Iona Craig, who has been covering Yemen for many years, describing the after effects of drone strikes, U.S. drone strikes, that she's witnessed in Yemeni villages. So, Chris Whipple, let me turn back to you about the efficacy or the effectiveness of these intelligence operations. I mean, has the drone program been effective for the CIA?
Well, it's a double-edged sword, to be sure. And even Michael Hayden, who was a staunch defender and is a staunch defender of lethal drone warfare. By the way, I mean, unless something's changed, I mean, this is almost unbelievable. But the CIA, as far as I know, to this day, does not officially admit that it operates lethal drones. But anyway, Michael Hayden, who's a real defender of drone lethal drone warfare, and who even talked to me out of school about the practice of so-called signature strikes, which we can come back to, but Haynes, you know, he's the first to admit that there's a real danger, you know, that we contribute to the jihadi recruitment video, as he put it. Do we create more enemies than we take off the battlefield? That's without a doubt a real risk of drone warfare.
Hmm. Rita, same question to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we don't really have evidence that over the long term that this is strategically effective, right? So people can point to, you know, the accuracy of the technology, which is itself debatable, or tactical successes in an individual to strike, you know, which again, there are many mistakes. But none of that really gets to the sort of question of the long-term strategic effectiveness of is this working? And I would point to the fact that we have been now on this war-based footing for two decades. Mm. So that suggests to me that this approach isn't working.
Do you see?
Can I just add to that one of the ironies here, though, I think, is we talked a little bit earlier about ending foreign wars and how drone warfare is surely a part of that. But I think that if you define foreign wars as conflicts with boots on the ground, as those wars are wound down, we're going to see an increase in drone warfare, not a decrease. Mm. And I think, for example, if you're Joe Biden, who in the past has advocated for getting troops out of Afghanistan, for example, you want to leave behind a capability to take out terrorists who may still threaten U.S. soil. And drone warfare is one of the best tools.
Point well taken, Chris, actually. And you want to leave behind that capability. But yet, as we're discussing today, in these, per Rita's point, roughly 20 years in this war on terror, there's still considerable debate about how effective that particular tool is. So, Rita, let me just ask you, are you seeing any signals thus far? I mean, I know the Biden administration's only been in place for 7 days, but say in the appointment of Avril Haines as DNI, that there's going to be any meaningful change in approach to the war on terror in the Biden administration?
I mean, I think Chris gets it exactly right, that this is going to be one of the central questions, that does the Biden administration want to sort of end the forever war simply by ending these large scale ground troop operations, but actually continuing this war-based approach to counterterrorism? Or are they really going to do the hard thinking to get us off of a war-based footing and framework and come up with sustainable and rights-respecting strategies. And that may include sometimes using lethal force, but under stricter standards for when lethal force is permissible outside of war. Otherwise, we're just continuing. And I think, you know, if you look back, what we saw were these countries where initially we didn't have boots on the ground and we didn't have large scale armed conflict, and we were just engaging in these sort of one-off drone strikes. Within a few months or a few years, we ended up in a large scale conflict in those areas.
Well, Rita Simeon and Chris Whipple, stand by. We're talking about Avril Haines, the new director of national intelligence, but specifically about what her actions and experience in the Obama administration tell us about how she might lead intelligence agencies in the Biden administration. So we'll be back with more. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about kids and screen time. So parents, write down this phone number, 617-353-0683, because we want to hear your stories about how, you know, we had been living in a world where parents were told to minimize screen time for young children, and then along came the pandemic and remote school and Zoom playdates, and suddenly we're all thrust into a world of maximal screen time. So what effect has that had on your kid? What are the downsides? What are the upsides? Tell us your story, your questions and concerns, 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's program. Today, we're talking about Avril Haines, the new Director of National Intelligence for the United States, the first woman to hold the top intelligence job in the country. Previously, she worked in the Obama administration on the National Security Council. She was also Deputy Director at the CIA. And we're looking at her work regarding the Obama drone program and torture at the CIA and the CIA, and asking what that means for what intelligence might look like under the Biden administration. And I'm joined today by Rita Simeon. She's Director of National Security Advocacy at Human Rights First. Chris Whipple is also with us. He's author of The Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. And Chris, I want to shift gears here a little bit and talk about the CIA and torture specifically, because that was something that Avril Haines was questioned on during her DNI confirmation hearing last week. But I want to ask you specifically, Chris, about the last CIA director, Gina Haspel, okay, because she's an important part of this picture. She ran, before she became the director for the CIA, actually ran a CIA black site, right, in Thailand. So she's been directly implicated in some of the CIA's torture programs.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, Gina Haspel's a fascinating character, you know, a covert operative for decades who flew under the radar, never gave any interviews as CIA director. One of the things that Donald Trump loved about her was the fact that she had been involved in the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. He famously said that he would bring back waterboarding and a hell of a lot worse during the campaign. You know, he never did so, and maybe that was the influence of maybe James Mattis talked him out of it. He famously opposed it. But the reality was, even even 4 years ago when Trump came into office, that the CIA was never going to go down that road again. As Michael Hayden put it to me, he said, if a president wants to do waterboarding again, and he'd better bring his own bucket, because we're not going there. And one of the reasons is, of course, that for one thing, it has now been outlawed. I mean, it's illegal. But more importantly, I think that the CIA felt that time and time again over the decades, they've been told to do things that they were assured were legal by presidents and offices of legal counsel. And at the end of the day, they're the ones who get punished. As Gates said, we've seen this movie before.
Mm. Okay, so that background is incredibly important. So folks, keep in mind that, as Chris Whipple said, that former CIA Director Gina Haspel has been previously implicated in that quote-unquote enhanced interrogation technique program that the CIA once was running. So taking this back to Avril Haines, the new DNI, last week at her Senate confirmation hearings, she got some questions about her views of torture. And the questions came from New Mexico Democrat Senator Martin Heinrich. And here's one of those exchanges.
I believe that waterboarding is in fact torture, constitutes torture under the law. And I do believe that all of those techniques, including techniques that involve cruel and human degrading treatment, are unlawful from a both domestic and international perspective, and should not be engaged in, regardless, as I said, of whether or not they're effective.
One of the outcomes of our report was we found that these were not, in addition to being unlawful under current law, they weren't effective because people were so desperate to make things stop that they would tell us almost anything. Do you agree that those techniques were not effective in their use?
Yes, Senator, I think that your report does an excellent job essentially of identifying how there are actually better alternative methods to get true, accurate information, and that is a reality. My point was only to say that even if they were effective, from my perspective, I would not allow them to be engaged in.
So that's an exchange last week from Avril Haines' confirmation hearing as DNI. Now, Rita Simeon, Haines is pretty clear there, right? She says that those activities should not be engaged in, that they're inhuman and degrading in treatment, and she would not allow them to be engaged in. The reason why this is so interesting to me, taking this back to Gina Haspel, who we know ran a CIA black site where torture took place. When Haspel was nominated to be CIA director, Avril Haines threw her support behind her, supported that nomination. So we have, there's a Senate aide who's been quoted in the Daily Beast who says, to have someone like Avril Haines touted for her record in advancing human rights and respect for the rule of law, I don't think that can be adequately squared with not only her recent record, but her deliberate choices of advocacy. So what do you make of the fact that she supported Haspel but says that torture is wrong?
Yeah, I mean, it's troubling, right? I don't think there's any question about her conviction, right? That she's telling the truth when she, you know, says that she believes that torture is wrong. It's not something that we should have engaged in or should ever engage in again. And that it's unlawful and it's wrong, period, right? I don't think there's a question that, you know, those reflect her views and the views of the Biden administration. But it is troubling that she was out there advocating for someone who ran a black site. And also, you know, for her role at the time as deputy director of the CIA and not holding anyone accountable for the CIA spying on the Senate investigators mm-hmm. of the torture program, right? So there's some troubling actions here, but, you know, there's always another side to the story too for, you know, why those on the inside that are having to make tough decisions, or in this case, you know, why she was defending or advocating on Haspel's behalf. I mean, there was some speculation that, you know, there was fear that if it wasn't Haspel, it would be someone far worse. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. But I think there are always multiple factors to consider.
Yeah. So you mentioned another one of those factors there that I think it's just worthy of reminding people of, that the Senate did investigate, right, the CIA's program, and that during that investigation, the CIA itself hacked into Senate servers, right? And then thereafter, no one was held accountable at the CIA. And in fact, Avril Haines was in charge of, I believe, sort of a panel that she'd been assigned to figure out who should be held accountable to that for those actions. No one was. And because of that, I mean, former Senator Mark Udall says if our country is going to turn the page on the dark chapter of our history that was the CIA's torture program, we need to stop nominating and confirming individuals who helped cover it up. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if there's one lesson to take from the last 4 years, it's that truth, accountability, adherence to the rule of law, they really matter. And by failing to acknowledge and account for the truth of the post-9/11 abuses, including the torture program, by failing to hold those who are responsible accountable in any meaningful fashion, so not just the spying on the Senate investigators who are conducting oversight of the program, but really not holding anyone accountable for the deaths of detainees, the brutal treatment and torture of detainees, we've really prevented the nation from learning valuable lessons and putting necessary safeguards in place to make sure that this never happens again. It's illegal now, but it was illegal then.
Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I can't disagree with anything you just said, but I also think it might be a little unfair to Avril Haines to assume that she had a dog in this fight. I think, you know, in the case of, she's not progressive's first choice as DNI because of a lot of the things that happened on her watch with drones and not holding people accountable. But let's not forget that it was really President Obama who made those calls. Obama wanted to turn the page from the 9/11 era. He didn't want to go after those people. And it was Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and constitutional law professor, who ramped up lethal drone warfare. So I don't think you can pin all of that on Avril Haines. You know, she's headed into a world of trouble with all kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. And God knows she doesn't need me to add anything to her to-do list. But one thing that I think really needs to be looked at is the whole issue of assassination of foreign leaders. And in particular, the case of General Soleimani of Iran, mm-hmm. who was killed in a lethal drone strike that reportedly Gina Haspel was gung-ho about. We don't know that for certain. But, you know, there are longstanding rules against assassinating foreign leaders. It's Executive Order 12333, which has been around since Reagan. And that whole issue just flew right by. And with our crazy news cycles, nobody really even looked into that.
Right. You know, I think one of the many reasons why I'm quite grateful for this conversation today is that this is a necessary exercise in complexity, right? As both of you are saying, there are certain things that are black and white. Torture, wrong. We have listeners writing in on social media saying about drone warfare, the discussion about how complicated this issue is disturbs me. It's actually quite simple. Would you like to live under the threat of someone blowing up your houses on your block? So lots of strong opinions on the black and white nature of drone warfare amongst some of our listeners. But the complexity here is that so much work, almost all of the work that's done by the 17 intelligence agencies of the United States are done in secret. We don't know. So these confirmation hearings are the one time or one of the few times where we can actually shine a light into these corners a little bit. And what we see is a complex picture, because what we haven't talked about, for example, is Avril Haines also, while in the Obama administration offering counsel to President Obama, radically expanded the number of people who were granted asylum to the United States. That page was totally turned by the Trump administration as well. So in the last couple of minutes of the show here, what I'd love to hear from both of you is, okay, so here we are. Endless war on terror, still going. The complex global picture, Chris, that you described, including we have China, Russia, Iran as well. What do you see are the additional greatest challenges for Avril Haines as DNI right now?
Well, she has, as I say, an incredible to-do list, and she's already talked about some of it. She has to look into the damage from that Russian cyber attack, which was extraordinary. She has to look into whether or not there were actually Russian bounties on U.S. soldiers. There's the rise of China. She has to determine the extent of the politicization that took place under Trump. And frankly, how much of a threat is Donald Trump going forward with all the intelligence that he has? She has to strengthen whistleblower protection. I think there has to be more transparency on drone strikes. And finally, I would say just one more thing, which is that she and the CIA director are not just the honest brokers of intelligence to the president. They have to be the brokers to the American public as well. There was no worldwide threat assessment in 2020, which is a public hearing where the heads of the intelligence agencies talk about imminent threats. And the reason is that apparently they were afraid to testify publicly to things Donald Trump didn't want to hear. The first thing that needs to happen is a worldwide threat assessment where they speak frankly to the American people.
Right. And in fact, Rita, as we know, the worldwide threat assessment also needs to look internally in the United States, the domestic terror threat. That's got to be on the DNI's list also.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's in addition to all of the things that Chris just listed, right? This just sort of like assault on truth itself and the assault on our democracy. These are issues that, of course, are like at the top of her list of challenges that she's facing. I think, you know, in terms of the forever wars, one point that we didn't really talk about yet is really actually the connection between some of the struggles that we are facing internally, in particular with respect to racial justice, and thinking about the connection between our own struggles here for racial justice and these actions abroad in terms of foreign policy. Would we be engaging in these types of strikes if it were people who weren't brown, for example, and really having to account for the racist aspects of some of these policies and grappling with that. And then I think also, you know, this administration really does, I think, want to end these wars, but it's going to have to grapple with what a new framework for using lethal force looks like. The policy we've been talking about for the past hour really only applies in a very narrow set of circumstances, and also was in large part reversed by the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. So this administration's going to have to sort out what does a new framework look like going forward that is sustainable and that gets the country off of a war footing.
Well, Rita Simeon is Director of National Security Advocacy at Human Rights First. She teaches courses on targeted killing, covert action, and the law of armed conflict at Georgetown and American University, Washington College of Law as well. Rita, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Chris Whipple, author of The Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. We have an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Chris, it was great to have you back. Thank you so much.
Great to be back. Thanks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.